A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been on a stationary and marking binge, prepping for a move, and he's noticed something. His favorite products, the stuff that actually works, keeps coming from two places, Germany and Japan. Edding industrial markers, Philips shaver heads, modular storage. And it's not just the products, it's the documentation, the manuals, the spec sheets, the assembly instructions. He's asking what it is about these two cultures, on opposite sides of the planet, that produces this same kind of excellence. And honestly, I've been thinking about the exact same thing ever since I opened an Edding 780 technical datasheet, and felt genuine delight.
The Edding 780 is a masterpiece of a marker. It writes on oily surfaces. It writes on greasy surfaces. It writes on wet surfaces. It survives minus 50 Celsius and plus 400 Celsius. And the datasheet doesn't just say, works on most surfaces. It lists 17 substrate types with expected adhesion ratings and chemical resistance for each one, including which specific solvents will remove it. That's not documentation. That's a love letter to functional reliability.
A love letter to functional reliability. That's the most Herman Poppleberry sentence ever uttered. But you're right. And I started asking myself, is this just me being a nerd about labels and shavers? Or is there actually something structural going on here?
There's absolutely something structural going on. And the structural thing most people miss, especially in the English language coverage of this, is that German engineering culture isn't really about the big brands everyone knows. It's about something called the middle stand.
Define that for people who haven't spent their weekend reading German industrial policy papers.
The middle stand is the ecosystem of small and medium-sized enterprises in Germany, often family-owned, often in tiny industrial towns you've never heard of, that dominate extremely specific global markets. The researcher Hermann Simon coined the term hidden champions for these companies. Germany has over 1,300 of them. These are companies with more than 50% global market share in things like laboratory glassware or industrial connectors or, and this is my favorite example, Fisher Fixing Systems.
The wall plug people?
The wall plug people. But calling Fisher the wall plug people is like calling Toyota the car people. It's technically true and completely misses the point. Fisher's UX wall plug documentation includes torque specifications, substrate compatibility charts, installation temperature ranges, information that most competitors bury in technical datasheets that only engineers ever see. Fisher puts it in the consumer packaging because they assume the person installing the wall plug actually wants to know whether it'll hold an aerated concrete versus solid brick.
That assumption, that the user wants to know, is the thing that feels different. Most consumer products treat documentation as a legal requirement or an afterthought. The German approach treats it as part of the product.
And that's not an accident of culture. It's an output of a very specific system. Germany has something called the Duales Ausbildung System, the dual vocational training system. About half of German secondary school graduates go into apprenticeships rather than university. They split their time between classroom instruction and on-the-job training at a company. By the time someone is writing technical documentation at a German manufacturer, they've probably spent 3 years learning both the theory and the practice of the thing they're documenting.
The person writing the manual has actually used the product.
Not just used it. They've probably assembled it, tested it, repaired it, and trained someone else on it. The documentation isn't written by a technical writing team that's been handed a spec sheet and told to produce something. It's written by people who understand what the worker on the factory floor or the customer at home actually needs to know.
That explains the thoroughness. But let me push on this a bit. What does that actually look like in practice? If I'm a 20-year-old German apprentice at, say, a company that makes industrial pumps, what's my path to becoming the person who writes the manual?
You'd start your apprenticeship at 18, splitting your week between a vocational school and the company floor. For the first year, you're learning the fundamentals, how the pumps are assembled, what the common failure points are, how to diagnose problems. By the second year, you're doing supervised repairs and you're expected to document what you did. Not formally, just notes, but you're building the habit of recording technical information. By the third year, you're probably contributing to the actual documentation. You're the person who notices that step 4 in the assembly guide is ambiguous because you just spent an afternoon confused by it. And because you're embedded in the company, you can walk over to the engineering team and say, "This diagram doesn't match the actual bolt pattern on the current model," and they'll fix it.
The documentation is alive because the documenter is embedded in the same building as the product.
Contrast that with a typical American company where the technical writer is in a different state, working from a product requirements document that was written 18 months ago by someone who's since left the company. The German apprentice turned documenter has what I'd call tacit knowledge, the stuff you can only learn by doing. They know that the pump sounds different when the bearing is starting to fail. That's not in any spec sheet, but it might end up in the troubleshooting section of the manual as, if you hear a high-pitched whine during startup, check the bearing clearance before continuing operation.
That's such a concrete example, and it explains why the documentation feels different. It's written by someone who's heard the whine.
But there's another layer to this that I think is even more interesting. The standardization culture. The DIN standards.
Oh, this is where I get genuinely excited. The Deutsches Institut für Normung, DIN, has over 34,000 standards. They cover everything from paper sizes to screw threads to documentation formats. DIN A4 paper? That's DIN standard 476, the standard metric screw thread. But here's the key thing. DIN doesn't just standardize products, it standardizes how you describe products. DIN 6608 specifies formats for technical documentation. There's a standard for how to write a standard. Of course there are. Standards for standards. That's the most German thing I've ever heard.
It's brilliant when you think about it. If every manufacturer uses the same format for spec sheets, the same terminology for describing tolerances, the same testing protocols, then a mechanic in Munich can read a datasheet from a supplier in Hamburg and know exactly what every number means without translation. It creates a shared language for precision.
That shared language means you can be precise without being verbose. If everyone knows what DIN EN ISO 9001 certified means, you don't have to explain it every time.
And this connects to something deeper in German engineering philosophy, a concept called Funktionstüchtigkeit. The idea that a product should perform its function reliably over a long period, and that this matters more than how it looks or how cheap it was to produce. German engineering prioritizes long-term performance over short-term aesthetics, and the documentation reflects that. It anticipates failure modes. It tells you what can go wrong and how to prevent it.
Which is the opposite of most consumer documentation, which pretends nothing will ever go wrong, and then leaves you googling error codes at 2 in the morning.
The Edding 780 datasheet is 4 pages long. 4 pages for a marker. And it doesn't just tell you what it writes on, it tells you what solvents will remove it from each surface, because they anticipate that someone might need to remove the mark, and they want that person to succeed too.
That's the thing. It's not just about making the product work. It's about making the entire life cycle of using the product work, including the part where you need to undo what you did.
That's where the Mittelstand structure really matters. These are companies that have been owned by the same family for 3, 4, 5 generations. They're not optimizing for quarterly earnings. They're optimizing for, and I know this sounds almost spiritual, but it's how they think. They're optimizing for the company still being world-class in 50 years. When your time horizon is generational, you invest in documentation because you know that documentation is what lets your customers trust you across decades.
The contrast with the American shareholder primacy model is pretty stark. If you're a publicly traded company and your bonus depends on this quarter's margins, you cut the technical writing budget. It doesn't show up in the numbers for years.
By the time it does, you've moved on to your next role. The Mittelstand owner-operator can't move on. Their name is on the building. If the documentation is bad and customers stop trusting the products, that's not a quarterly miss. That's a family legacy damaged.
I want to stay on this point for a second because I think there's a specific mechanism here that's easy to miss. When we say family legacy, we're not just talking about emotional attachment. There's an actual financial structure at play. These middle stand companies typically have very low debt. They're not leveraged to the hilt trying to maximize return on equity. They're self-financed through retained earnings. So when a recession hits, they don't have to fire their technical writers to make debt payments. They can keep investing in the things that don't pay off immediately.
And it creates what you might call a patient capital environment. The documentation team isn't a cost to be minimized, it's an asset that compounds over time. Every year you maintain and improve your documentation. It gets more valuable because it accumulates more edge cases, more failure modes, more hard-won knowledge. If you fire the documentation team during a downturn, you don't just lose this year's manuals. You lose the institutional knowledge that was walking around in those people's heads.
That knowledge is almost impossible to rebuild from scratch. I remember reading about a German manufacturer of industrial printing presses. I think it was Koenig and Bauer, where the technical documentation archive went back to the 1920s. They had maintenance procedures for machines that had been in operation for 80 years. When a customer in South America called about a press from 1953, they could fax over the original service manual with annotations added over decades.
That's the kind of thing that sounds absurd until you're the customer with the 1953 press and you realize the manufacturer still has your back. That's not just good service. That's a structural advantage. That customer is never buying from anyone else.
Okay, so let's fly to the other side of the world now. Completely different history. Completely different cultural tradition. But the output feels remarkably similar. What's the structural story there?
The structural story starts with a word that's hard to translate but essential to understand, monozukuri.
Break that down.
Mono means thing or object. Zukuri means making or crafting. But the compound word means something more than the sum of its parts. Monozukuri is the philosophy of making things with craftsmanship, with continuous improvement built into the process, with an almost spiritual attention to detail. The Japanese government formally recognized this with the Monozukuri Basic Law in 1999, which essentially declared manufacturing skills to be national cultural heritage.
A government declaring manufacturing a cultural heritage asset. Meanwhile, in most Western countries, we spent the last 40 years telling kids that factory work was a failure bath.
And that law wasn't just symbolic. It funded training programs, it created centers of excellence. It sent a signal that making things well was a form of national achievement. But Monozukuri goes much deeper than a 1999 law. It connects to an older concept, shokunin.
The master craftsman idea.
Yes, but shokunin isn't just about traditional crafts. A shokunin is someone who has mastered their craft to the point where the work becomes an expression of character. The classic example is Jiro Ono, the sushi master, but the concept extends to modern manufacturing. A Toyota line worker who has spent 20 years installing door panels is expected to embody shokunin. They're not just following a procedure. They're expected to notice when something is slightly off, to understand why it matters, and to stop the line if necessary.
Which brings us to the Andon system.
The Andon cord, introduced by Toyota in the 1960s. Any worker on the production line can pull a cord that stops the entire line if they spot a defect. Not a supervisor, not a quality inspector. In some Toyota plants, this system has reduced defect rates to less than 1 per 100,000 vehicles.
That's a radical act of trust in the worker. And it only works if the documentation is precise enough that anyone can identify what wrong looks like.
That's the key insight. The Andon system creates a demand for excellent documentation. If you're going to empower every worker to stop production, you need to give every worker the information they need to know when stopping is justified and when it isn't. The documentation has to be so clear that a new hire on their first week can spot an anomaly.
Let me give a concrete example here, because I think it helps. I visited a Toyota plant a few years ago, and at each workstation there was a laminated card, maybe 8 inches by 10, that showed photographs of the correct installation and photographs of the 3 most common defects for that specific part. So a worker doesn't have to interpret an abstract drawing. They just compare what's in front of them to the photo. If it doesn't match, they pull the cord.
That's a perfect example of what I mean by documentation that's designed for the actual user. The person who designed that card didn't just know the engineering specs. They knew that the worker is standing at the line for 8 hours. that fatigue affects visual judgment, that a photograph removes ambiguity in a way that a diagram doesn't. That's Shokunin applied to documentation.
This is where Japanese documentation differs from German documentation in a really interesting way. German manuals tend to be systematic and text-heavy. Here are all the steps. Follow them in order. Japanese documentation is often more visual and more contextual.
The MUJI assembly instructions are the perfect example. MUJI modular storage systems come with exploded diagrams, no text at all. Pure visual communication. It works across every language, every literacy level, every cultural context. A German manual would give you torque specs in Newton meters. A MUJI diagram shows you a picture of the screw going into the hole with a little arrow indicating the direction of rotation. And somehow, that's all you need.
It's the difference between systematic thoroughness and contextual thoroughness. The German approach says, here is every piece of information you might possibly need, organized logically. The Japanese approach says, here is exactly the information you need at the moment you need it, presented in the way that's easiest to absorb.
Both are forms of thoroughness. They're just thorough about different things. The Japanese approach is thorough about anticipating user errors. Japanese documentation often includes troubleshooting guides that assume you will make mistakes, that show you what a mistake looks like and how to recover from it. German documentation tends to assume you'll follow the instructions correctly and focuses on giving you complete information.
That's a fascinating distinction. The German manual is written for an idealized, competent user. The Japanese manual is written for a real human who will definitely put the shelf bracket on backwards at least once.
That difference reflects deeper cultural assumptions about authority and expertise. In the German tradition, the documentation is authoritative. It's the voice of the engineer speaking to the technician. The assumption is that the technician is competent and wants complete information. In the Japanese tradition, the documentation is more like a guide or a teacher. It's designed to help the user succeed even if they're not an expert.
The German approach respects the user by giving them everything. The Japanese approach respects the user by anticipating their struggles.
And both are forms of respect. They just express it differently.
Let's talk about the business structure in Japan, because I think there's a parallel to the Mittelstand that matters.
The Kyaretsu system. Kyaretsu are networks of companies with interlocking business relationships and shareholdings, long-term supplier relationships that create shared standards and expectations. A company like Toyota doesn't just buy parts from suppliers. They have decades-long relationships where Toyota engineers work alongside supplier engineers to improve quality. The documentation standards cascade through the entire supply chain.
If you're a small parts supplier and Toyota is your customer, Toyota's documentation standards become your documentation standards. And because these relationships last for decades, it's worth investing in getting it right.
And the Kyaretsu structure means that quality expectations are mutual. The supplier knows that if they maintain quality, the relationship will continue. The buyer knows that if they support the supplier's improvement efforts, they'll get better parts. It's a long-term partnership rather than a transactional relationship where you switch suppliers every quarter to save 3 cents per unit.
I want to contrast this with the Western procurement model for a moment, because the difference is stark and it directly affects documentation quality. In a typical Western manufacturing company, procurement is evaluated on cost savings. The buyer's bonus depends on reducing the per unit price of components. So they run a competitive bidding process every year, pitting suppliers against each other. The supplier who wins is the one who cut the most cost, and that almost always means cutting things like documentation, quality control, and customer support. Those are the first things to go because they don't show up in the unit price.
In the Kyaretsu model, the procurement relationship isn't evaluated primarily on unit cost. It's evaluated on total cost of ownership over the life of the product. If a slightly more expensive supplier provides better documentation that reduces assembly errors on the line, that's a net win. But you can only see that if you're measuring over years, not quarters.
You can only act on it if the same person who makes the procurement decision is still around to see the consequences. Which brings us back to time horizons.
The Mittelstand and the Kyaretsu are structurally different, but they share one thing. They create time horizons that are long enough for quality to matter.
That's the thread that connects everything we've been talking about. In both Germany and Japan, the industrial structure incentivizes long-term thinking. The middle-stand family owner is thinking about their grandchildren inheriting the business. The Kiretsu supplier is thinking about a relationship that's already lasted 30 years and could last 30 more. When your time horizon is measured in decades, you invest in documentation. You invest in training. You invest in making things that last.
You invest in the kind of precision that only pays off over time. A torque spec in a wall plug manual seems like overkill until you're the person whose shelf didn't fall off the wall after 10 years.
There's a concept in Japanese manufacturing that encapsulates this. Kaizen. Not revolutionary change, not big disruptive innovations. Just small, incremental improvements made constantly over time. The documentation reflects this. If you look at a Japanese product manual from 20 years ago and compare it to today's version, you'll see dozens of small refinements. A diagram that's been clarified. A warning that's been added because someone, somewhere, made that mistake. A step that's been reordered because it flows better.
That's the opposite of how most companies approach documentation. Most companies write the manual once, translate it badly into 17 languages, and never touch it again until there's a lawsuit.
The translation point is worth dwelling on for a moment, because it's a whole subcategory of documentation failure. You know the classic example. The instruction manual that tells you to please to be inserting the screw in the hole with gentle pressure until the click sound is heard. That's not just bad translation. That's a company that didn't care enough to hire a native speaker to review the text. And if they didn't care about that, what else didn't they care about?
There's actually a fun fact here that's relevant. The German and Japanese approaches to translation are completely different, and both are better than the standard Western approach. German companies tend to write documentation in simplified, controlled German. First, a restricted vocabulary and grammar designed for machine translation accuracy, and then have domain experts review the output. Japanese companies often skip translation entirely and go visual, which is why so many Japanese products have those wordless instruction sheets. Both approaches solve the translation problem by taking it seriously rather than running it through Google Translate and calling it a day.
The documentation is a signal in yet another way. If the manual is in 17 languages, and all of them read like they were written by a native speaker, someone cared. If the manual is wordless but perfectly clear, someone cared in a different way. If the manual reads like it was translated by a confused robot, nobody cared at all.
That's why the documentation is such a good signal. If a company treats the manual as a living document that improves over time, they're probably treating the product the same way. If the manual is a PDEF from 2014 with broken diagrams, that tells you something about how much they care about your experience after you've handed over your credit card.
What can we actually do with this? If you're not a German middle-stand CEO or a Japanese shokunin, how do you apply these lessons?
I've got three actionable takeaways. First, when you're evaluating a product, look at the documentation first, before you buy. Most people read reviews, watch unboxing videos, check the specs. But the manual is a proxy for how much the manufacturer cares about your long-term experience. If the manual is thorough, clear, and anticipates problems, the product probably is too. If the manual is a badly translated single sheet with no troubleshooting section, the product was built to be sold, not to be used.
That's useful. What's the second one?
The best consumer products often come from companies that also serve industrial or professional markets. The Edding 780 is an industrial marker that happens to be available to consumers. Philips makes shavers for consumers, but they also make medical equipment where documentation is literally life or death. The documentation standards from the B2B side carry over to the consumer products. So, when you're shopping for something, look for brands that have an industrial or professional division. The documentation culture tends to be stronger across the whole company.
The third takeaway?
This one's for the listeners who create documentation themselves. Software documentation, hardware specs, process manuals, whatever. Borrow from both traditions. Use German systematic checklists for completeness. Make sure you've covered every scenario, every failure mode, every edge case. Then layer in Japanese visual troubleshooting. Use diagrams, flowcharts, screenshots that show what wrong looks like and how to get back to right. The combination is more powerful than either approach alone.
The German structure plus the Japanese context. That's a useful framework.
It works because the two approaches compensate for each other's weaknesses. Pure German-style documentation can be overwhelming. Here's a 400-page manual. Good luck. Pure Japanese-style documentation can sometimes skip details that a power user needs. Combined, you get completeness plus usability.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about the education systems, because I think there's a deeper point here that explains why both countries produce this kind of excellence, despite very different approaches. In Germany, you've got the dual vocational system, half classroom, half on the job, producing workers who understand both theory and practice. In Japan, you've got a system built on rote learning and rigorous testing, producing workers who are comfortable with precision and standardization. Very different methods, but both produce a workforce that respects procedure.
In both cultures, there's a shared assumption that there is a right way to do things, and that learning the right way is valuable. In some other cultures, and I'm thinking of the American emphasis on creativity and disruption, following the procedure can sound like a criticism. In Germany and Japan, following the procedure is a sign of competence.
When following the procedure is culturally valued, you get better procedures, because people invest in making the procedures worth following.
There's a virtuous cycle. If the culture values precision and procedure following, then the documentation gets better because people actually use it and complain when it's bad. If the culture treats documentation as an afterthought, nobody reads it, nobody complains, and it never improves.
The Edding 780 datasheet is 4 pages because somewhere in the company's history, someone needed to know whether the marker would work on polypropylene that had been exposed to cutting fluid, and the company decided that person deserved an answer.
They documented that answer so the next person wouldn't have to ask.
Which brings me to a question I don't have a good answer for yet. As AI-generated documentation becomes more common, and it's already happening, companies are using language models to generate manuals. What happens to this cultural specificity? Does AI flatten everything into a generic global style? Or could it actually let us combine the best of both approaches?
I'm uncertain about this. On one hand, the worst-case scenario is that AI generates documentation that's technically complete, but culturally empty. No German thoroughness, no Japanese contextual awareness, just statistically probable sentences about how to assemble your shelf. On the other hand, you could imagine AI systems that are trained on the best documentation from both traditions and can produce manuals that are systematically complete and contextually helpful.
The optimist in me thinks the second one is possible. The pragmatist in me thinks most companies will use AI to cut costs and produce the cheapest acceptable documentation, not the best possible documentation.
That's probably right. But here's the thing. The companies that use AI to produce excellent documentation will have a competitive advantage. Just like the middle-stand companies that invested in documentation 50 years ago are still benefiting from customer trust today. The time horizon problem doesn't go away just because the technology changes.
That's really the core insight of this whole conversation. The difference between German and Japanese engineering culture and everyone else isn't some mystical national character. It's structural. It's about who owns the companies, how long they expect to own them, how workers are trained, and whether documentation is treated as a cost center or a product feature.
The next time you're frustrated by a product, check the manual. If the manual is bad, the product probably is too. Good documentation isn't a nice to have. It's the visible surface of a deeper engineering culture. You can't fake it. Either the company invested in making things work over the long term, or they didn't.
That's the thing I keep coming back to. Daniel's question was about why German and Japanese products feel different. And the answer isn't that Germans and Japanese people are somehow inherently better at making things. It's that both countries have built systems, educational systems, industrial structures, cultural values, that reward long-term investment in quality. The documentation is just the most visible symptom.
The documentation is the canary in the coal mine. Or rather, the canary that's alive and thriving because someone wrote a 4-page datasheet on proper canary care, including substrate compatibility and chemical resistance.
Solvent removal instructions for when the canary gets into the Edding marker.
You always need to know how to undo what you did.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, a pure finder in South Sudan, a person who collected dog waste for use in the tanning industry, could gather approximately 18 kilograms per day. For comparison, a modern automated street sweeper in Juba collects roughly 1,200 kilograms of mixed debris daily, of which only about 6% is organic waste usable for industrial processing.
Right.
That's a mental image I didn't need, but will now carry forever.
Here's what I'm left thinking about. The next product you buy, whatever it is, a toaster, a shelving unit, a marker. Pull up the manual online before you click purchase. See what the company thinks you deserve to know. It'll tell you more than the reviews will.
If the manual is 4 pages for a marker, you've probably found something worth keeping.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.